restaurant had to offer. When I came in, they gave me a look that said, yes, I know the kind of person you are. You're all the same to me. Right? And the restaurant was starting to get busy, but it was not full. We wouldn't have to wait long, they said, and they looked down at the schedule and intoned, hey, it will be a few minutes while we prepare your table, monsieur. Please wait here. Yet, he didn't even move. He looked down, scribbled a tiny note on his seating chart, and began to ignore me. 15 minutes passed. I watched as the best tables began to fill. I looked at the manager, a little bit anxious, and he held up his index finger, indicating, hey, only a minute more. I returned to talking to my guests, defending my choice of restaurant and commenting on how good the food really is. I promise you it'll be worth the wait, I told them. Finally, when the right amount of time had passed, the manager stepped away from his podium and said, Madame, Monsieur, your table is ready, waving at us towards a table with an open palm and outstretched arm. He seated us, handed us menus, and told us that Benoit would soon arrive to take our orders. A trainee brought water and bread, smiled, and then disappeared. Another 15 minutes went by before Benoit appeared, and the first thing he did was flash me a rebellious look. Do you know what you would like to drink? He asked, looking at the hand-tooled, leather-bound wine list resting near my left hand. I didn't recognize many wines on the list, so I played the part of good host and ordered an expensive bottle for the table. This was Benoit's opportunity to perform a small but defiant act and to seize control of the high-status position, taking it away from me. You almost could hear the power transfer, clean and smooth, like the flip of a switch. Monsieur, I do not think this wine is the best choice. He grimaced, taking the wine list away from me. Benoit turned the page and paused. I was embarrassed, and my face turned red. Well, all wines in our cellar are fine wines. You must select a better pairing for this evening's meal, he said. He scanned our table, making eye contact with my guests, ignoring me. He suggested various meals for my guests, and after several minutes, finally returned his attention to me. He flipped open the wine menu, stabbing his index finger at a wine that would meet his standard. His recommendation was less expensive than the wine I had chosen, so I gave up on my selection and gave a nod to his. Oui, an excellent choice, monsieur, he announced to the table, pretending to the group that it was my knowledge and not his that resulted in the best choice. I was the butt of the joke, and my guests were laughing at me. Benoit flashed me a look that said, this table is mine. The wine arrived, and Benoit carried out the time-honored ritual of corking, testing, and decanting. He executed the steps with precision, tradition, and respect for his craft. My guests were in awe. Only when it had been established that the wine would meet his exacting standards did he even offer me, the host, a first taste. At this point, he could have served me stale vinegar, and I would have said that it was heavenly just to save face. I wasn't sure whether I was angry with Benoit or just amused that he had turned me into a low-status dork. Benoit had simply and effectively grabbed local star power. He had captivated the attention of the table, and now, in full possession of the social power that I once had, he decided to redistribute some of the power to further strengthen his position with my group. As Benoit settled into a smooth rhythm of frame controls and status moves, I could see the game unfolding perfectly. Acts of small defiance, seizing status, redistributing it, taunting me to behave like a beta. I was at the center of a masterclass on frame control. As the wine was poured around the table, one of my guests smelled her wine and asked, is it a Bordeaux? Benoit stood tall, placed a hand on her shoulder and said, Madame clearly knows French wine. This Bordeaux is from a small winery that most people mistake for Cannes. Your palate is very sophisticated. This comment absolutely melted her, and her eyes were sparkling with emotional pyrotechnics. The table was smiling, and again, I was ignored. Let's pause to review what Benoit, this practiced master of social frame control, had accomplished. First, he seized local star power by using simple, seemingly innocent and benign acts, and he isolated me by making me wait. As I discussed earlier, the croc brain is a social organ that craves acceptance and belonging. No one likes being made an outsider, especially when there are guests to impress. Then, after ostracizing me, Benoit swooped in, using his superior domain knowledge, and made me look like basically a fool. He then quickly rescued me from a mistake he had allowed me to make. He knew that without first understanding what kind of food the table would be ordering, it would be impossible to order the wine. And yet, he asked me to make a wine selection first. No matter what I ordered, my order would be wrong. Hey, thanks, Benoit. He called out my mistake and then quickly polled the table for the information needed to make the correct decision. He chose the correct wine, making sure it was a better wine at a lower price than the one I had chosen. And then he gave me credit for making the proper choice. This was an early masterstroke that secured his control of the social power he had taken from me just 2 minutes earlier. His next move was to strengthen his position by co-opting one of my guests into his frame, making it impossible for me to attack him without simultaneously attacking her. He waited for someone to comment on the wine, anyone, any comment, and lavished praise on them to distribute some of his social power to that person. When one person joins his frame, the others will follow. And now the table was his. Voila! Back to the dinner, right? As expected, the entrees were awesome, and Benoit suggested a second bottle of wine, something a little different to capture the flavors coming from the progressing meal. Benoit appeared more regularly now, floating around the table, collecting information, making suggestions, and basically doing the hard work of protecting his superior social position. My guests had told me that this was one of the best meals they'd ever had. I thanked them for joining me and then gave Benoit an appreciative nod. At first, I wanted to smack Benoit, but now I was really starting to like him. As the plates were cleared, Benoit disappeared. I had an expectation that something more was coming, but what would it be? 10 minutes went by. Where was Benoit? I knew something was up. I was right about that. Benoit had chosen the dessert. Moments later, a gleaming silver cart was rolled to our table, followed by a cart lined with brandy and cigars. Behind all this was the coffee cart. The attendant filled individual French press cylinders with freshly ground coffee. Ladies, gentlemen, for this evening's dessert, I've taken the liberty of making something special for you, Benoit announced. What he meant was, I have taken over your host's mind and bank account, right? Rum cake, he announced, our most famous dessert, a light and delicious cake made with cream, rum, and a little sugar. Please, enjoy. The table applauded, and Benoit cut the cake with flair. I was so owned by Benoit at this point that it really no longer mattered. I smiled, relaxed, and decided that Benoit was going to get the largest tip he'd ever seen. In fact, the tip is the only power I had left in this situation. My guests were delighted, and now, as the evening closed over coffee and brandy, Benoit slowly released some social power back to me for a very good reason. The check was coming, and I was sure it would melt my neocortex. Ladies and gentlemen, it has been a pleasure to serve you this evening, Benoit gushed. He deftly placed a small silver tray near my left arm. On the tray was a tiny slip of paper turned face down. No itemized bill could possibly fit on this minuscule slice of paper. Just a single number would be on it. As my guests warmly thanked Benoit with hugs and handshakes, I managed to peek at the bill, flipping up the corner like a poker player, not wanting to show any reaction. It wasn't as bad as I thought. With the performance Benoit gave and the control he held throughout the evening, I was expecting him to take advantage of me. He had the power to do so, but in the final display of total frame control, he chose moderation over self-indulgence. Now, I was absolutely delighted, and the large tip I was thinking of leaving him was just raised. Let's talk about the alpha and the beta. It doesn't matter how well you argue, the way your points are crafted, or how elegant your flow and logic. If you do not have high status, you will not command the attention necessary to make your pitch heard. You will not persuade, and you will not easily get a deal done. As you are now starting to realize, pitching any kind of deal involves playing a complex and tricky status game. And before I talk about the ways to win the game, and possibly ways to lose it as well, I should cover the real advantages held by the person with the highest status, the alpha. The alpha enjoys most of the attention in a social interaction, even when he's not demanding it. And when he does demand it, the alpha captures the group's attention immediately. When he makes a statement, it's regarded as true, and the claims go unchallenged. There's plenty of evidence to suggest that the alpha in a group is trusted and followed without question. To illustrate this, researchers have set up many tasks in which men, dressed in high-status business suits, jaywalk across a busy street when it's unsafe to cross. Lower-status pedestrians tend to follow the high-status decoy right into the danger zone. They will not follow someone who is dressed badly, however. When you take the high-status position in a social interaction, you feel it, and it is also felt by your audience. Do not underestimate the importance and value of status to your overall success. For more than 40 years, sales trainers have been teaching techniques and methods that help situationally disadvantaged salespeople, you know, those with low social value, get an appointment, establish a temporary relationship, which they call building rapport, and that contributes absolutely nothing to your social rank, and package a business transaction in a thin, fragile, emotional wrapper, and sometimes, if they're either lucky or doggedly persistent, close a sale. During the 70s and 80s, those techniques worked. But even then, only for the most tenacious, hard-driving, type A personalities. Still, the purveyors of what I call process-based sales methods continue training millions of ambitious salespeople in seminars from coast to coast. Today, it's difficult to find an executive who isn't familiar with the techniques like building rapport, pushing features and benefits, overcoming objections, and trial closing. As a consequence, after generations of this process-driven business behavior, targets know how the sales game is played. Use this stuff and they will see it coming. Even the best of these techniques are now so commonplace that clients have developed strong defenses and barriers to block them. These defenses are called beta traps, meaning that you're held in a subordinate position to the target at all times. You are owned from start to finish. There is no substitute for holding a position of high status. The good news is that you don't have to be a celebrity or a billionaire to enjoy high levels of social status. There are ways you can create it instantly, and with that, you can capture and hold the attention of any audience or target. The first step towards elevating your social status is to avoid beta traps. Let's talk about beta traps. In social interactions and business meetings, as in nature, those who hold the dominant alpha rank are able to accomplish more than those holding a lesser rank. Alphas call the shots, give the orders, and create the outcomes they want with a minimum of effort. It's important to them emotionally and economically to remain the highest ranking person in their social group. Because they occupy a coveted rank, alphas have to constantly fight to maintain and protect their position. As top dog, their rank is under constant threat, and alphas protect themselves by asserting their authority over their employees and coworkers. They ask subordinates to run errands, to bring them coffee, and deal with matters that are disinteresting to them or deemed to be below their rank. These are the nicer forms of dominant turf-protecting behaviors. Many who hold alpha rank behave in far worse ways. To shield themselves from people of higher social rank who visit them in their work environment, they erect a protective ring of social barriers intended to deflect and demote any threatening alphas. A beta trap is a subtle but effective social ritual that puts you in the low status position and works to keep you there, beneath the decision maker that you have come to visit for the entire duration of the social interaction. Most business environments are surrounded by a moat of beta traps that you already recognize and know. The reception desk, the lobby, the conference room, and any public meeting space in or near the office. The first beta trap you encounter is the lobby. It's a venue created to welcome visitors, right? In fact, the lobby serves to demote you from the moment you arrive and keep you demoted throughout your visit. You know the drill. How many times have you experienced this scenario? You enter the lobby of the office where you'll be meeting your target. You approach the reception desk. The receptionist looks up, "Hey, can I help you?" and then takes a call before you can even answer. You stand, you wait, and you take a business card from the tray on the counter. The receptionist transfers a call and then looks at you. "Yes, can I help you?" Then you say, "Yeah, I'm here to see Bill Jones for a 2 o'clock. I talked to you earlier, I think," and you confirm. The receptionist then looks past you. "Sign the visitor's book, please. Here's your visitor's pass. Keep it with you at all times. Please take a seat. Bill's assistant will come and get you in a few minutes." She then turns to finish a text message to her boyfriend, whatever. You take a seat in the lobby. A table filled with dog-eared trade magazines and week-old newspapers indicate that others like you have been here before. This sequence, in translation, reads as follows. Be a well-behaved salesperson. Do as you're told, and you shall be rewarded with a bottle of water, a short visit, and a vague promise to review your materials and information after you leave. When you observe the office power rituals, you are signaling to your target that you are a beta. At 2:10 p.m., a young aide approaches you. Hi, yes, Bob is running a little late. Shouldn't be more than another 10 minutes. Water and coffee are over there. Help yourself. You blink, and she's gone. Your target arrives late, offering a mock apology for his impossible schedule, telling you that he now has only a few minutes and still hasn't had a chance to review your materials. And now the decision maker, Mr. Big, won't be able to attend the meeting as planned. Sorry. At this point, you have been beta trapped and are completely and utterly defeated. You might as well go home. What a demoralizing way to do business. Yet this is how millions of people set and conduct business meetings. It's a waste of time because the behaviors and outcomes are so predictable and so unproductive. Another common beta trap is the conference room. If it's empty when you arrive, you are usually left alone for several minutes, cooling your heels while you wait for your targets to arrive. When they arrive, the mood is often jovial with lots of light social chatter, smiles, and handshakes. They're happy because they're now taking a break from their daily work to come into a nice, larger room to see today's entertainment. That's you. Who isn't happy when they step into a circus tent and take a seat at ringside? They know a show is about to start, and they're looking forward to relaxing and having a good time. As you wait for the latecomers, the decision makers you really need in the room, conversations are now taking place that do not include you. Others talk to each other as if you were not in the room, which is not only annoying, but it's also one of the most rude and degrading things one person can do to another. In this situation, you are the jester in another king's court, and your value is purely based on the quality of your entertainment. You have no status whatsoever. Then, there are public spaces where customers sometimes decide to take a meeting. Hey, let's get a coffee and talk, they say, leading you to a cafeteria or close by cafe where you exchange small talk in the queue and manage an awkward moment over who should pay for drinks. You take a place at a nearby table within earshot of a dozen strangers. This is no place to give a pitch. Your status level is zero. You are owned, processed, and now you are nothing but a pleasant social interlude in an otherwise boring day. But you press on, right? Believing in yourself and your offering. You open your pitch and are moving along nicely when suddenly someone walks up to your customer and starts talking to him as if you do not exist. Hey, Jim, how's it going? The intruder says, shaking his hand and ignoring you. Did you get my email about the shipping delays in Dallas? They continue the conversation for a while as you can do nothing but stare. Eventually, when he decides he needs to go bother someone else, the intruder leaves and your customer turns back to you. His face is blank, his eyes are empty, and his brain has stopped functioning. Where were we? He asks. Okay, need I go on? There have been many frame collisions in this interaction, but you didn't win a single one of them. You have no control over this situation. In general, public spaces are the most deadly beta traps and should be avoided. For a real pitch, coffee shops are an absolute last resort. I will mention one more public beta trap because it's common. Trade shows and conventions. If you exhibit at trade shows, you know that the absolute worst possible venue for pitching a customer is a tiny booth and the convention floor. There are so many distractions that not even a frame control ninja could hold an audience's attention for more than a few minutes without being interrupted by noise, announcements, bag-carrying conventioneers mindlessly gathering free items and pens to fill their brightly colored sacks. If you need to pitch someone attending a conference, rent a hospitality suite or a hotel conference space or borrow someone's office or conference room. Pitch anywhere but on the floor of a convention hall. A person standing in a trade show booth may as well erect a neon sign over his head that reads, I am needy. Like a caged pet shop puppy or a late night infomercial host, you try to draw them into your 8x10-foot cube and hope to wow them with your pitch. It's sad. Let's talk about beta trapping in Bentonville. In the town of Bentonville, Arkansas, the art of beta trapping has been taken to an unparalleled level. You might call it the frame super collider. The world leader in the design, construction, and operation of beta traps is Walmart. At its headquarters in Bentonville is the world's most efficient salesperson grinding apparatus you will ever see. No matter what you have to offer the company, no matter how great its value, to do business with Walmart, you must submit to a process that is designed to beat you down and wipe out your status, all in the name of lower prices. Think I'm exaggerating? Go to 702 Southwest 8th Street in Bentonville. Walk into the lobby. There you will find two enormous reception desks, one on each side of the room with a hospitality area on the far right filled with grade school style chairs with writing desks attached to them for those who need to fill out forms. The perimeter of the room is lined with junk food vending machines for those who need a quick energy boost to endure what is coming. Between the two reception areas is a gleaming blue hallway marked with the Walmart logo, and that leads to another long hallway lined with dozens of 6x8-foot meeting rooms. These meeting rooms are equipped with a door, a window, and one small table, and four small plastic chairs. These rooms are where Walmart buyers meet with vendors. Let's look at the company's process. First, you sign in, receive a visitor's badge, and are told to wait in the lobby. You're welcome to enter the company's hospitality room, and you can purchase candy and Walmart-branded soft drinks from the vending machines. The person you are visiting receives a message that you are in the lobby. When the buyer is ready to meet and you're paged to the reception desk, you're walked back to an assigned meeting room where you're instructed to wait for your buyer to appear. As you are escorted to your assigned meeting room, you are allowed to see other vendors through the small glass windows of their cells. When you reach your cell, you're instructed to remain in the room until you are escorted out. Finally, the door is closed. Eventually, one or two buyers will enter your cell and your meeting will begin. The meetings are short and focused on what? Price, volume, logistics, your financial ability to support the Walmart account, and then on price again. Price is methodically and systematically driven down, where your logistical and product support responsibilities are increased until you can no longer negotiate. When this point is reached, the Walmart buyer makes a decision, buy or not, and then moves on to the next item in your product category. The frame is so tightly controlled that even the most successful selling techniques do you absolutely no good. Walmart turns everything into a commodity, and every commodity is acquired through this process. Using scale, magnitude, and domination psychology for purchasing, Walmart has created the most effective frame super collider in the history of free enterprise. This is an extreme example of how beta trapping strips you of your power and ability to do good business. Old-fashioned sales techniques can help a little bit, but really, you're disadvantaged, you do not control the frame, and you are at the mercy of the buyer. To compensate, you would need an enormous amount of self-confidence and self-belief to be convincing enough to succeed. You are forced to browbeat, manipulate, and cajole targets into buying decisions, and this is precisely why conventional sale methods focus on what's called pressure closing. Most of us just don't have the required stamina and chutzpah, and I certainly don't, and it's emotionally draining to have to make 100 sales calls to win an order or two. When you're held down in the beta position, the only tool you have at your disposal is emotional manipulation. At best, it works in the moment, and maybe you can land a deal or two, but your success is random, and it's not satisfying because the buyer really does not want to buy. He's doing the purchase to please you, and he'll regret it later, and that's called buyer's remorse. There's a much better and more natural way to attract business opportunities. You simply elevate your social value, and it's easier to do than you might think. Let's talk about the cardiac surgeon and the golf pro. Most golf professionals make their living by teaching the game, running golf clubs, operating golf courses, and dealing in golf equipment, not by caddying for touring professionals like Phil Mickelson. In the United States, at least, the label golf pro means an experienced golfer who helps other golfers with their game. It's a fun job. In many ways, being a golf pro is a dream job. You're working outside, you're teaching people a sport, and you're getting paid for it. So what's the catch? Well, it doesn't pay well. And being a golf pro does not bring much in terms of global status. That is to say, when someone asks what you do and you say, I'm a golf pro, it's not like saying, I'm a CEO, or I'm a doctor, or I'm a professor. In fact, it's more like saying, I'm chronically underemployed, and that doesn't carry much cachet. What should we make of this? Is the golf pro any less intelligent, sociable, or reputable than, say, a cardiac surgeon from a regional hospital? No, of course not. The only difference is that the golf pro holds a lower position on the social hierarchy. Your position in the social hierarchy is an artificial measure of your worth to others, a construct based on your wealth, your popularity within society at large, and the power of the position that you hold. This is not my formula. This is the way we measure each other. The golf pro doesn't make a lot of money compared to a cardiac surgeon. That makes his social status even lower. Or is it? When the surgeon takes a lesson with the golf pro, the status of each suddenly becomes more fluid. Something called situational status takes over. Out on the golf course, whatever wealth, power, and popularity the surgeon has becomes irrelevant. The domain has changed, and with that comes instant and significant changes in social value. Once the surgeon stepped into the realm of the golf pro, his status fell, and the golf pros rose. And this change in social elevation remains in effect for as long as the surgeon is in the golf pro's domain. The golf pro's situational status is suddenly very high, now much higher than it was back in the parking lot. Now, the golf pro tells the surgeon what to do, when to do it, and how to do it. If the surgeon doesn't comply, the golf pro reprimands him. Through a simple domain change, the roles have reversed. And it is in this role reversal that we begin to see the incredible power of situational status. Think about this for a moment. Your social value is fluid and changes with the environment you are in or the environment you create. If you want to elevate your social value in any given situation, you can do it by redirecting people into a domain where you are in charge. And this is easier to do than you might think. Our position in the social hierarchy is not locked in place. While the global status of our social standing may remain whatever it is, our situational status can be mobilized in order to temporarily create a high status position whenever that is needed. While we temporarily hold high power, we can get a lot of things done as effectively as those with financial or political high status. This is called creating local star power. Super important. With local star power, you'll be able to succeed in pitching audiences who just don't even know you. The first impression we make on another person is based on that person's automatic calculation of our social value. As a survival mechanism, the other person's brain is making it a priority to understand where you fit in the social structure. The person makes a really hasty judgment using three measurable criteria: your wealth, your power, and your popularity. Based on some quick mental shorthand, the person is going to assign you a social status level, and from that calculation, a frame will be fixed. The person will not necessarily even consciously think about this. The people jaywalking behind the man in the nice suit, if you recall, did not deliberately pause to consider his status or think about whether it meant he was likely to cross streets safely. They just automatically calculated his likely status and crossed the street with him and behaved in accordance with his status. Elevating your social status. The first thing you do when you meet a target is to establish your local star power. If your meeting happens to be on your turf, like the golf pro or the French waiter, use your domain expertise and location knowledge to quickly take the high status position. If you're meeting in the target's domain, his office or an offsite location, you must neutralize the person holding high status. Temporarily capture his star power and redistribute some of his status to others in the room who support your frame. I've given you two examples of situational status and how to capture local star power. Now let's look at how you can elevate your status when your target is coming at you with the power frame. I want to talk to you about the hedge fund manager. A couple of years ago, I took a meeting with Bill Gar, a hedge fund manager. The meeting was arranged by a mutual friend, guy Dan. Arriving a few minutes early, I checked in with the receptionist and immediately recognized the lobby beta traps. Sign the guest book. Here's your visitor's badge. Take a seat. And how about a stale cup of coffee? Someone will attend to you shortly. Looking around the lobby, I made a quick read of the situation. Green marble floors, modern chrome and leather furniture, rich accents, all designed to convey a single message. I'm rich. I'm powerful. Fear me. Revere me. I knew what this was. I was on a conveyor belt headed straight for the status-crushing machine. Soon, my forehead would be stamped beta, and I'd have a 15-minute meeting with Bill, and they would be shown the door. I knew instinctively that our first frame collision would not yield power to me. While I waited for Bill, I began to think of another way to acquire high status and take control of the frame. Eventually, an assistant ushered me back to Bill's corner office. The level of luxury had been taken up a notch. His private office was, quite frankly, it made the lobby look like a construction trailer. Teak furniture, Persian rugs, titanium and glass fixtures, a couple of dozen framed pictures of Bill with various politicians and celebrities. And from his windows, a panoramic view of Beverly Hills that rivaled the view from Mulholland Drive. "Have a seat," Bill said, without looking up from a document he was reviewing at his desk. I took a seat at the conference table by the window. "No, come over here," he said, pointing to a low-slung chair in front of his desk. "The secretary's chair. Great," I thought to myself, and I took the seat. Bill was old school, and he enjoyed using classic power rituals like seating people below him to confirm his position as Lord William. I began to feel excitement because I have learned that the bigger they think they are, the harder they fall when my hook point is set. But I could sense it was going to be a real challenge to get there. Bill pressed a button on his phone and said, "Hey, Gloria, please ask Martin and Jacob to step in." A moment later, two smart-looking Ivy League MBAs came trotting in, and they'd taken their subordinate seats on either side of mine. "I'm surrounded," I thought. "Okay, Bill, points for style." Bill reached into a rare ceramic bowl sitting on his credenza and plucked out a large red apple. As he did, he asked me to hold on another moment, and he asked Gloria to email someone or that he'd forgotten to call. Turning back to me and his underlings, he propped one foot against a desk drawer and took a large bite from his apple. He set it on the desk while he searched for a napkin, and that's when I saw my first opportunity. While he was chewing on his bite of fruit, I tried to get some kind of frame control. "Look, guys, I only have 15 minutes, so I'm going to get right into it. This is the deal I'm working on." And then I quickly briefed them on the project. But this was too frail an attempt, and it didn't accomplish much. The status gap between us was too big to be overcome with just this weak attempt at frame control. I could see that Bill was hearing every third word I was saying. He was really more interested in his apple than in any opportunity that I'd come to offer. I made a good opening, and my pitch was progressing, but my status was still too low to have any chance of getting this deal to the closing table. "I'm good at this stuff," I said to myself. "Just don't force an error. Wait for it." That is when I saw a golden opportunity. After years of dealing with similar but not quite as difficult social situations, the idea formed in my head, and I knew how to crush his frame, captivate attention, and establish high status for myself with one simple move. I said, "Hey, I need a glass of water, excuse me," and I raced for the kitchen I'd seen on the way in. There, I grabbed a glass of water, a paper towel, and a plastic knife. I thought, if this doesn't work, Bill is going to grab this knife out of my hand and kill me with it. I walked back in, but I didn't sit. I nodded towards the apple that already had a bite out of it, and I said, "Listen, Bill, I hope this isn't how you do deals. In a real deal, everyone needs a piece. I'll show you what my deals look like." I reached for the apple on his desk. "May I?" Not waiting for an answer, I took the apple, cut it in two, and took half for myself. As I returned the half apple to the place on the desk where Bill had set it, you could hear the roar of silence. The Du Bois, Martin and Jacob, were stunned, and Bill was staring at me with mean and squinty eyes. I took a bite of the apple, chewed it quickly, complimented its flavor, and commented a little bit more on how our deals always have been split fairly down the middle with investors. Then I finished the pitch, acting as natural and as informal as if I was having a conversation in my own living room with my friends. The three of them listened to every single word from that moment on. I focused intently on the parts of the deal in which I had expertise. Like Benoit before that I had mentioned, or the golf pro, I was working hard to establish local star power. When I had finished, and before Bill could speak, I quickly began to pull away. "Whoa, look at the time," I said, comically glancing at my watch. "I've got to run. Listen, guys, thanks for your time today. If this works for you, let me know." As I reached for my portfolio and began to slide out of the chair, Bill waved his arm in the air and said, "Wait, wait, "Wait a minute, Orin." And then he started hysterically laughing. This relieved the tension for Martin and Jacob. They smiled and laughed nervously with their boss. And I sat as straight-faced as I could while Bill got a huge laugh out of his system. "I can definitely see why Dan thought I should meet with you. Listen, tell me again who else you have in this deal." The hook point was made. For the next 20 minutes, I answered questions and exchanged information with Martin and Jacob and Bill, and they were tasked with due diligence. And I continued pulling away, looking at my watch, worried about arriving late to my next meeting. Finally, I just stood up to leave. And as I was shaking Bill's hand, he said, "Hey, if Marty here and Jake tell me that the numbers check out, well, I'm in. Let's do the deal." What this example demonstrates is that a well-chosen, well-timed, friendly but disruptive act will dethrone the king in a single stroke. In that brief, shocking moment when no one is quite sure what you've just done, that is when your frame takes over and when high status transfers to you. To keep my frame going strong after the Apple thing, I just ignored anything that didn't advance the pitch. This is an important lesson. In general, just ignore conversation threads that don't support your deal and magnify the ones that do. I kept talking about the deal, and you'll see specifically some of the things I talked about in Chapter 4. Here's a quick review of what happened in Bill's office that day. 1, I found myself in Bill's office with no frame control and in the beta position. 2, I perpetrated a mildly shocking but not unfriendly act that caused a new frame collision. 3, as the shock of my action wore off, the attention of the targets did not waver. Believe me, it never does when you do something like this. And I continued accumulating status. The faster you grab status, the more is available for you to take. 4, as I captured attention, I then shifted my focus to acquiring local star power and the alpha status. 5, I got local star power by using information dominance to quickly shrink the frame around my area of specialization, making me unassailable. Because I was the expert, no one could undermine my deal points. 6, using my newly acquired local star power, I quickly moved the discussion to a level where I could not be challenged by using the primary core values of hard work, domain expertise, and moral authority. And we'll discuss more about that in a few minutes. 7, the moment I was done with my pitch, I began to pull away, and I kept pulling away until finally I just left their office, but not before I'd set the hook point and received a preliminary decision. These rules are applicable to any situation where you're pitching on someone else's territory. Here's some other important things to remember. If you think you'll start a meeting from the beta position, always be on time for the appointment. When you're late, you're just giving away power. It's difficult to establish strong frames when you can't play the game of business by its most basic rules. Also, momentum is key. Create high status immediately. Do not hesitate. Choose a frame, force a frame collision, and at the most opportune moment, and do it early. The longer you wait, the more you reinforce the status of your target. Another thought, avoid social rituals that reinforce the status of others. Idle social banter just diminishes your status. Also, have fun. Be popular in that environment. Enjoy your work. There's nothing as attractive as somebody who's enjoying what he or she is doing. It attracts the group around you, and it allows you to build stronger frames and hold them longer. As we've been saying, when you're the high status person in a social interaction, you get all the good stuff. When you're the alpha, life is easy. The statements you make are trusted. The emotions you show will set the overall mood in the room. And most importantly, when you speak or gesture or even look like you might speak or gesture, people will turn their attention towards you. Just remember, this process is geared to build and seize situational status, and that's temporary. Once you leave the social encounter, it's wiped out, gone. And if you come back later, you'll have to start over and build it again, even if that's only 5 minutes later. And you won't be able to seize global status. That's the honor or prestige attached to a person's position in society. Global status is the sum of a person's wealth, popularity, and power. For example, you're not going to sit down with a billionaire and have him believe that you're somehow a triple billionaire. Global status is fixed. It's only situational status that you can grab and control. Fortunately, you do not need to be rich, famous, or powerful to enjoy status in your business encounters or in your social situations. If you do not have high status, you can create it temporarily. Let's summarize this seizing situational status. Here are the steps involved in elevating your status in any situation. You will recognize some of these actions from framing, and really for a good reason. Frame control and status are closely related, as are the pitch techniques you'll learn in the upcoming chapter 4. So 1, politely ignore power rituals and avoid beta traps. Number 2, be unaffected by your customer's global status, meaning the customer's status inside and outside the business environment. Number 3, look for opportunities to perpetrate small denials and defiances that strengthen your frame and elevate your status. Number 4, as soon as you take power, quickly move the discussion into an area where you are the domain expert, where your knowledge and information are really unassailable by your audience. Number 5, apply a prize frame by positioning yourself as the reward for making the decision to do business with you. Number 6, confirm your alpha status by making your customer make a statement about you that qualifies your higher status. This last step, it's really of vital importance, and it's not as scary as it sounds. As I pointed out earlier, I do not abuse the power I'm holding by committing overt acts of dominance. Instead, got to be playful with lots of give and take that makes business fun. One of the best ways to get a customer to confirm your alpha status is to make him defend himself in a lighthearted way. Not only does this let you know you're still in control, but more important, it also reminds the customer that he holds a subordinate position to you. The customer will defer to you even in front of his underlings. I may say something like, "Hey, remind me again, why in the world would I ever want to do business with you?" This usually gets a few laughs and a serious response amidst all the laughter. "Hey, Oren, you want to do business with us because we're the largest bank in California." To which I would say, "Yeah, that's good enough. I'll keep that in mind." It needs to be playful and interesting with just a little edge to it. Keep the customer qualifying back to you in this way as long as you can. Do it as much as possible right up to the point when it becomes a little awkward or it's just like taking a little too much time. Ask another qualifying question. "Hey, guys, have you ever done a deal this large before?" And so this is the best way I've found to get an audience to qualify my dominant frame. Now that you have an understanding of frames and how to create and use status to support frame control, let's move on to the heart and soul of my method, the pitch. Chapter 4, Pitching Your Big Idea. In 1953, molecular biologists James Watson and Francis Crick introduced the world to the double helix DNA structure. That's the so-called secret of life. And it's widely considered the most important scientific discovery of the 20th century. Their presentation earned Watson and Crick the Nobel Prize. And what is most striking about this accomplishment is that the full presentation takes just 5 minutes to read aloud. That's the complete presentation, introducing the secret of life, explaining it in detail, and showing how it works. Pause and consider this for a moment. The most important scientific discovery of the 20th century can be pitched in 5 minutes. Yet, nearly every pitch that I've seen, and I see hundreds every year, takes at least 45 minutes and usually an hour. A ridiculous amount of time. No company in America should let its executives pitch for an hour. In a moment, you'll see why. Let's get into pitching the big idea. So far, we have worked in the realm of frames and status, which are abstract notions. Now, however, lace up your shoes and tuck in your shirt. It's time to get in front of someone and deliver a real pitch. And if you're the front man, the guy who has to take a big idea on the road and pitch it, you need to know exactly how to give a complete presentation in a much shorter time frame than most other people. But as you'll see in a moment, short time frames are not a choice. You can't afford to run longer. The audience's brain won't give you more time. And worse, when attention runs dry after about 20 minutes, the brain starts forgetting things it had already learned. Talk about going in reverse. As soon as a pitch or a presentation begins, one critical thing must happen. The target must feel at ease. In the vast majority of cases, they don't, because they don't know how long they're going to be stuck listening to you, and you're a stranger. Most people just don't want to sit through an hour-long pitch. To put them at ease, I have a simple solution. It's called the time constraint pattern. This is what you say exactly to let the target know he isn't trapped in the typical hour-long meeting. Guys, let's get started. I've only got about 20 minutes to give you the big idea, which will leave us some time to talk it over before I have to get out of here. Doing it this way puts the target at ease. It shows that you know what you're doing and that you're a pro. Look, anything can be pitched in 20 minutes by a pro. It also shows that you're busy because you have a big, strong idea and you can't hang out too long in this meeting or in any single meeting to talk about it. What's important here is not your mastery over the details, but your mastery over attention and time. Instead of trying to achieve what is virtually impossible, that's holding the target's attention for longer than 20 minutes, we need to observe the limits of the human attention span. You're going to make the pitch in four sections or phases. Here's what they are. Number one, introduce yourself and the big idea. That's about 5 minutes. Number two, explain the budget and the secret sauce that you have. That's about 10 minutes. Number three, offer the deal. That only takes 2 minutes. And number four, stack frames for a hot cognition, and that takes about 3 minutes. That's 20 minutes in total. Let's get into more detail here. Phase one, introduce yourself and the big idea. Following this formula, the very first thing you need to do, even before you think about explaining your idea, is to give people your background. But you have to do this in a specific way. Your success depends on how well and how fast you do it. After the introductory chit-chat, where you establish status and use frame control, it's natural for the target to ask, hey, what's your background? Or how did you get started in this? At that point, you can begin the pitch starting with your track record of successes. Not a long rundown of the places you worked. Not all the projects you were tangentially involved with. Not your whole life story. The key to success here is making it about your track record. Things that you have built. Projects that you were on that actually worked out. Successes. Spend less than 2 minutes on it and definitely not more. And don't worry, before your pitch is over, the target is going to know a whole lot more about you. When a friend of mine, Joe, was getting ready to get financing from Boeing, here's how he did it. Number one, hey guys, my degree is from Berkeley. I did my MBA at UCLA. Number two, after that, I was at McKinsey for 4 years, but really, my only home run there was a sales program I built for Lexus. I saved them about $15 million, and they still use it today. Number three, I left consulting 6 months ago to work on the big idea that we're going to talk about in the next few minutes. Yeah, for sure. Joe has done a lot more than that over the years. But so what? Only his big wins are worth talking about at this point. Is there a lot more to your background than this? Of course, there is. But in the pitch, time and attention are not infinite. In fact, they're extremely scarce. And you're going to need all the time available to get and keep frame control. Plan to stroke your own ego later, when the deal is more likely to go through. Many times I've seen people spend 15 minutes or longer on their background. That's absurd. No one is that fantastic. You know, people always think if some background biography is good, then more is better. But people's brains do not work that way. Research has shown that your impression of someone is generally based on the average of all available information about them, not the sum of the information, the average. So telling people one great thing about yourself will leave them with a better impression than you telling them one great thing and one pretty good one. And it gets worse if you tell them one great thing, one pretty good thing, and two mediocre things. Just stop by telling them one great thing about yourself. Get your track record on the table and do it fast, clean, and problem-free. This is not the place to get hung up with questions, deep conversations, and analysis. There is still a lot to do. Is this different from what you're used to? Is framing it this way a completely new way of looking at pitching? Yes to both. But if you don't feel like changing to frame-based pitching, you can always console yourself with the fact that you are not alone. Wasting time and focusing on the wrong things are problems that exist at the highest levels of business. Let's talk about the why now frame. You're almost ready to pitch the big idea, but first, a reminder of the obvious. Nobody wants to invest time or money into an old deal that has been sitting around for some period of time. This is why you need to introduce a why now frame. It's vitally important that the target knows that your idea is new, it's emerging from current market opportunities, and it's not some relic left over from bygone days. The target needs to know that you're pitching a new idea that came to life from a pattern of forces that you recognize, that you seized, and that you're now taking advantage of. And the target needs to know that you have more knowledge about these things than anyone else. There are unspoken questions in the target's mind as to why your idea is relevant and important and why it should be considered as important right now. By anticipating these questions and definitively answering them before they're verbalized, you will tick an important checkbox in the target's mind and put the target more at ease. Everything you say from that point forward will have context, greater meaning, and more urgency, reinforcing its scarcity. What I've discovered over time is that in every business, there are three market forces that together triangulate to answer the why question. And you can use these forces to create a strong why now frame. So let's talk about trend casting and the three market forces pattern. When you describe your idea, project, or product, first give it context by framing it against these three market forces or trending patterns, the ones that you believe are most important. So first of the forces is economic forces. Briefly describe what has changed financially in the market for your big idea. For example, are customers wealthier? Is credit more available? Is financial optimism higher? Increases or decreases in interest rates, inflation, and the value of the dollar are considered as prime examples of forces that have significant impact on business opportunities. Number two is social forces. Highlight what emerging changes in people's behavior and patterns exist for your big idea. An obvious example in the market is for automobiles. Concern over the environment, a social force is driving demand for electric vehicles. And number three, technology forces. Technological change can flatten existing business models and even entire industries because demand shifts from one product to another. In electronics, for example, change is rapid and constant, but in furniture and furniture manufacturing, change is more gradual. Describe the genesis of your idea, how it evolved, and the opportunity you saw as it was emerging. The backstory of the idea is always interesting to the target. Once the story is told, everything you say in your pitch will be legitimized by it. As you craft your backstory, think in terms of how it came to be where it is today and how you found it. Describe the steps in its evolution and show how it evolved, how it moved to finally become the opportunity you have now identified and captured. The three basic steps to do this are: number one, explain the most important changes in your business. Forecast the trends. Identify important developments, both in your market and beyond it. Number two, talk about the impact of these developments on costs and on customer demand. And number three, explain how these trends have briefly opened up a market window. Here's an example that ties the three market forces together into a very tight pattern that supports the why now frame for a product. Let's just call it Upright, a device you wear on your wrist that wakes you up slowly at exactly the right time so you feel well rested when you wake up. So the economic force. The cost of making this product has gone below the $10 mark. This means the retail price point can now be $69. We've been waiting 2 years to hit this price point. That's an important economic force. The social force. One of the changes in our society is that people don't get enough sleep or even the right kind of sleep. While this problem is growing only 2% a year, awareness of it is skyrocketing. People know that they need better sleep. It's a hot topic at all levels of society. That's an important social force. Against this backdrop, your idea begins to occupy the foreground in the target's mind. To continue, go with this discussion of the technological force. This device requires a controlling chip and a solenoid that now can be manufactured small enough and at a controllable price, allowing us to do mass market manufacturing. That's an important technological force. By starting your pitch with the three market forces, your idea now enjoys a prominence that it did not have before. Now your idea has a history, an exciting evolutionary path to the present time, and it has credibility. The idea is displayed against the economic, historical, and sociologic changes that made it emerge from the shadows. But it has just barely emerged. You were alert, and you saw the potential, and you are now developing it. This is a nice point to strengthen your prize frame, by the way. It does not matter what your idea, project, or product is. They all have a history and legitimacy when framed within the three market forces pattern. With the three market forces pattern, everything has a story that can be told. As you write the why now frame for your idea, start by thinking in the broadest terms possible, going back as far as you need to go to understand and explain how it came from the past into the present and why it's special. Remember, it doesn't matter if you're pitching jet fighters, securities, real estate, software, or cotton balls. You need to frame your deal in this way because it explains the force behind its evolution. Movement is a critical element in the why now frame. Your target needs to understand the forces that are pushing your deal and to understand that your success is inevitable and imminent as a consequence of these forces. This is another area where you need to understand how the crocodile brain of your audience or your target is working. A huge part of the brain is devoted to detecting movement. This is what makes it so hard to find things you have lost in the moment. Your keys, your cell phone, or pencil, they don't move. You can look right at something and not see it because it is standing still. This is why animals, when they're frightened, tend to freeze. Your brain grows accustomed to things that are not changing, and then they effectively vanish from sight. A bird holding its head very still can hunt efficiently because the only thing it can see is a wiggling worm. If you injected your eye muscles with curare, a paralytic poison, the same thing would happen to you, even without such injections. It is clear that movement captures your attention. And this is what you want to take advantage of with your pitch. You don't show people a static picture of how the world would be if your plan were implemented, but instead you show them how your idea is moving away from the current standard to a new way of doing things. There's one more detail about the brain and how it works that you need to know, and it's called change blindness. It is surprising, but if you show people two pictures in rapid alternation, and one of those pictures has some change in it, even a relatively major change, people will not see it. You can replace grandma and a tree in two different photos. It does not count as movement when you do it this way, and the brain ignores it. You can hunt and hunt for what is different between the two pictures as they go back and forth from your vision, and you still think they're identical. It is only when your attention is focused deliberately on the thing that is changing that you can finally see it. Once you know this fact about how your audience's mind works, you realize you cannot just show audience members two possible states and hope that the difference captures their attention. You need to show the movement from one to the other. We are not wired to see or hear a static pitch. That was the old way, but this is the new way. That can trigger change blindness, where the target won't get or understand your deal at all. The formula I've just given you, the three changing market forces, overcomes the potential for change blindness. With three market forces coming into alignment, you are literally showing the mind's eye how the market is moving to benefit your big idea. Here's an example of my colleague Joe giving a pitch. Hey guys, in recent years, there hasn't been much going on in the business of building new airports. In fact, it would be fair to say that the market has been dead, but now things are heating up. Three major forces are changing the market. First, banks have started lending to aviation projects. Second, the Federal Aviation Authority, the FAA, is now issuing building permits where they previously weren't. And third, our main competitor is excluded from bidding on this deal because they have a conflict of interest. 1, 2, 3. The target sees that there's a market rationale for Joe's airport deal. It makes sense. The combination of the bank's new willingness to lend, the new FAA pressure on the airport, and the lack of competition have created the opportunity for this deal to happen now. One of the most important things I've learned that has made every one of my deals possible is that targets simply do not like old deals. They want to see movement, and they don't like deals that have been sitting around for a while, that have been ignored by other investors or partners. It would be like the copier salesman saying, "Hey, how would you like the Model T-100? We've got 50 of them in the warehouse, and they've been hanging around forever." Introducing the big idea. This does not take 15 minutes. It takes 1 minute. You don't have to explain the big idea in great detail. Oh, I know you want to. It's instinctive. First, introduce yourself, then dive into the details. I get the same urges to do it that way. And it seems like the perfect time to do it at the beginning of the meeting. But the beginning is not the time for details. Your target doesn't want to know the details yet. So the pitch temperature is cool. Lots of details will turn it stone cold. The details can come later. First, you will establish the big idea using the idea introduction pattern. The venture capitalist Jeff Moore, who I know, developed this pattern in 1999, and it still works today. Let me tell you about the idea introduction pattern. It goes just like this. For target customers who are dissatisfied with the current offerings in the market,